It is with a great deal of trepidation that I present on this topic, because opinions on this can be quite heated and extreme. Some people, I fear, will look at the title, which was not, I didn't object to the title, but I didn't create the title, and immediately roll their eyes because the implication is that people are innocent until proven guilty, which to them sounds like an attempt to ignore abuse, since it is often hard to prove. And this is troubling, especially in light of the scandalous past behavior of many members of the community's leaders, including its rabbis, in ignoring abuse. Of course, there are other people who will be absolutely convinced of the innocence of people because they know the person. He or she couldn't possibly be guilty, and there's so much of witch hunting since the pendulum has swung from ignoring abuse to seeing abuse even when it's not there. And then there are the people who sometimes behave a little bit like a lynch mob, and even when a person has been cleared or ruled not to be a danger to anyone, are determined to exclude that person from any kind of participation in the community, either out of ignorance or because of powerful people who have their own vendetta. And while there is little doubt in my mind that the long-standing problem in our community has been that of ignoring abuse, and not of punishing innocent people, we should still be careful of seeing abuse in every corner when it's only there in some of them. One general statement I think that needs to be made at the outset. The practical application of halacha, psika, is a combination of law and facts, or halacha and mitzias. In the case of abuse, cases of doubt typically involve questions of facts, or interpretations of facts, not questions about the law or the halacha. The people best equipped to make those judgments in all of their manifestations and ramifications are trained health professionals, investigators, not rabbis. Rabbis qua rabbis have no expertise in this area, unless one believes, as I don't, that there are issues of turning to the authorities in this country or in Israel because of Mesira. I don't think there is much of a point in going to the rabbi before going to the authorities. If one is not sure how to interpret what one has seen and whether or not it warrants going to the authorities, for example, the New York State mandated reporters have to report when they have reasonable suspicion. In the state of New Jersey, every adult is a mandated reporter and has to report in situations of reasonable cause. But sometimes what is reasonable suspicion? The person to consult with in that case is a qualified mental health professional. I can think of two reasons, maybe there are others, to consult a rabbi in circumstances of abuse. Number one is if you need to find a mental health professional and you don't know of any, the rabbi might be a good resource for that. The second would be in a case of going to the authorities will not help, either because the abuse isn't technically criminal. For example, if you're dealing with young adults who are above the age of consent, they're 18 years or older, and you're talking about sexual abuse, but technically speaking, it's not illegal because the young individual might have been willing. It's not willing, but nonetheless. Or if the victim or the family won't cooperate with the authorities. So then, in that case, the rabbi's job as part of the communal leadership is to help protect the community regardless of what the authorities can or can't do. But fundamentally, most of the doubts in cases of abuse are questions of mitzias and best decided by those who are qualified, and those are not rabbis, at least qua rabbis. The abuse that I want to talk about, or I'm referring to here, is the abuse that takes place under the roof of communal institutions, such as schools, shuls, youth organizations, camps, and the question of danger to the community. Of course, abuse in the private setting is horrible and criminal and subject to the appropriate reporting, but it is often more of a private import. And it is often only a danger to the members of that family, not the community. And outside of shunning, and certainly not regarding the abusers or member in good standing of the community, there often isn't that much that we can do. From what I understand, the majority of the abuse in our community actually is of that nature. Most abusers, from what I understand, most victims of abuse know their abusers quite well. But, as I said, I think that my charge in this particular case, this year, is really addressing abuse as it takes place under the rubric of the community, but we certainly also need to pay a lot of attention to private abuse. In cases of communal institutions where there is abuse or a credible allegation of abuse as determined by a judgment of a qualified individual, it now becomes the communal responsibility, A, to report the allegations, And B, sometimes to make a decision as to the continued involvement of the alleged abuser in that institution. The question of innocent until proven guilty is really a reformulation of a broader question, which is what to do in situations of suffix, of doubt. And I want to delineate what I see as three different kinds of doubt. Perhaps there are more, but this is what I would break them down into. The first situation of doubt is when there's an allegation of clear abuse. The doubt is as to the veracity of the allegation. That is to say, if what has been alleged has actually happened, then it is abuse without a doubt. It's a he says, she says question. The second kind of doubt is when there is behavior which may or may not be inappropriate in its own right, but the concern is that it is a sign of something else that might be going on, but we don't know. Here, there are some things that we know happened, but we are not sure if they led to some things that are clearly wrong. One sees, let's say, a colleague, a teacher, behaving in a way with students, which in itself isn't criminal, but it makes you worry that maybe when you're not looking, they're actually going further. This assumes, obviously, that the victim doesn't make a claim, or the possible victim alleges misdoing, but you see something that makes you wonder. So in this case, you know some of the facts, but again, you don't know all of the facts, and that's the question. The third is when there is a behavior that everybody sees what is going on, but we're not quite sure how to interpret it. Sometimes we wind up with a situation where some people think that what they experience, people that some would say should be considered victims, they think it was wonderful. And other people in that same situation feel that they were vulnerable and victimized. In this case, there is no doubt as to what is going on. We know what the facts are, but the doubt lies in how to interpret those facts or how to understand that behavior. The first two of these kinds of doubt are potentially criminal, and that is what most of my makoros, my sources, will focus on. The latter is probably the trickiest. It is almost by definition not criminal, because if it were criminal, there would be no doubt in people's mind that it was abuse. And I will return to that third kind, which I think is of great concern to us as a community, briefly at the end of this year. One last introductory note as a lesson to us as a community, our institutions, and to each one of us as individuals, especially those who work in communal institutions. The best way to resolve doubts is to ensure that they are not likely to happen in the first place. And this is done by adopting what is often termed as best practices. The halacha has many of these. For example, the prohibition of yichud, of seclusion with members of the opposite sex, of lo sikrevu, of physical contact. These are basically what we would call best practices. They might not be necessarily criminal in their own right, but they raise concerns and they can lead to problems. Many organizations and professionals have developed such guidelines. In my line of work, I have a policy. I don't meet with undergraduate students in my office alone unless I take the paper off the window in the door or I leave the door ajar. And I teach young men. On the rare occasion that I get a student from Stern College who wants to meet with me, I never meet with them in my office. I go to the Heights Lounge, to a very public sphere where I will meet with them. There are at least two benefits to adopting best practices. Number one, for the individual, for the teacher, for the employee, they make it less likely that someone will be tempted and accidentally transgress. But two, for us as a community, when someone transgresses official best practices adopted by their institution, they have effectively moved the needle in the question of doubt, where now we have less concern of risking finding an innocent person guilty because they have already violated institutional policy and established something of what we call raglayim ledavar, a reasonable suspicion. When they assert their innocence and claim they actually didn't do anything, we at least can say to them, they've already broken the rules. And now, they're already essentially guilty. And now the question is, are you guilty of something which is minor, or are you guilty of something which is much more major? And now when we're not sure, I think that we have a lot more latitude. The great halachic challenge in dealing with abuse cases where there is genuine doubt is that we are trying to balance the rights of two individuals. There is no such thing as being machmir, being stringent. Being machmir for the benefit of one party is always at the expense of the other party. If there are people who are being abused or are in danger of being abused, and we fail to protect them, we violate a very severe prohibition of lo samar al dam re'acha, of allowing someone to be harmed, and we stand idly by. But if a person is tainted with accusations of abuse when he or she is innocent, his or her life and livelihood can be destroyed, and often that of his or her family. And I should stress that the loss of livelihood is not a trivial thing. The Gemara in Yevamos on Daf Ayin Ches Amud Beis speaks about an incident in Sefer Shmuel where there was a drought for 3 years. And when David HaMelech asked God, why was there a drought? So one of the things that he was told, that it was a punishment because King Shaul had killed a number of the Givonites. So the Gemara says, where do we find that Shaul killed the Givonites? He didn't murder any of them. So the Gemara answers that when Shaul wiped out the city of Nov, Ir HaKohanim, the Givonim, who were the water drawers and the wood choppers for the temple, so they lost their livelihood. And because he cost them their livelihood, God treated it as if he had killed them. Let me be clear here. If a person is guilty of abuse, we don't spare them because of the anguish and loss to his or her family, or their parnasa, or their livelihood. Such a notion is preposterous. Our obligation is to punish the abuser and remove the danger, and then to educate the community that we have to be extra sensitive to family members of the abuser when they have done nothing wrong. In the sources, there are three things that I want to address. Number one, situations of doubt in general in a halachic judicial context. Number two, rules of evidence, especially since most abuse takes place in a private context where there are no witnesses by definition, certainly not kosher witnesses. Finally, three, briefly, I want to address the question of mesira, the question that is sometimes raised in some quarters about reporting people to the secular authorities. First, situations of doubt in the world of halacha. As a starting point, it seems quite clear that the halachic system, and I think this is true not only about halacha, I think it's true about American jurisprudence as well, is heavily biased in favor of acquitting and against convicting. The Torah states in Parshas Mishpatim, source number one, Midvar sheker tirchak, v'nokivit tzadik al taro ki lo atzdik rasha. So the Torah says, don't kill a naki or a tzadik. What's the difference between naki, an innocent person, and a tzadik, a righteous person? So the Mechilta explains, I believe it's quoted by Rashi in his Perush on Chumash, that a naki refers to someone who is truly innocent. And if a person has been convicted in court and is being taken out, let's say, to be killed, and someone says, I have evidence to exonerate them, the Beis Din stops the execution and they will revisit the case. That's a naki, we may not kill a naki. A tzaddik is someone who is nitzadek be-Beis Din. He's someone who's guilty, but was acquitted by the court for whatever reason. And in that case, the Torah also says that once a person has been exonerated in Beis Din, and someone says, I have new evidence that might convict them to execute them, we don't revisit the case. The Torah also demands that we have very clear witnessing. Situations of what we call umdina, of estimation, of circumstantial evidence, are generally not, at least formally speaking, accepted. Certainly not in capital cases. In source number three, the Mishnah describes how the court would try to intimidate the witnesses in capital cases. They want to make sure that the witnesses understand the consequences of their testimony. And the Mishnah states, Ketzad ma'ayimin es ha'edim. Al edei nefashos, when it comes to a capital punishment, we would bring them in and we'd try to scare the living daylights out of them. Shema tomru me omer mishmua. Maybe the basis of your testimony is not that you actually saw someone commit the crime, but rather you saw something that looked like they were committing the crime. And that is not accepted evidence. The Gemara comments that even when it comes to dine mamonos, this particular question of using circumstantial evidence is a debate amongst the Tanoim. But certainly when it comes to what we would call punishment in the classic sense, we keep away from circumstantial evidence. The Rambam in the Sefer HaMitzvos explains something very interesting. He states, this is source number five, that dvarim ha'efsharim, which means things that are possible. Possible means circumstantial evidence. The Rambam states that there's a whole spectrum of circumstantial evidence. There are efsharim, there are things that are krovei ha'efsharos ma'od, not only likely possible, but very likely that they happened on the one hand. You have some things that are in the middle, and then you have some things that are possible but unlikely. And the Rambam states that the Torah prohibits categorically judging on the basis of the efsharios, of the possible, of the circumstantial. Why, the Rambam says? Because you'll start with, we'll use circumstantial evidence when the probability, I would say, is 90% that the person is guilty. And that's actually quite reasonable. But then, slowly, slowly, you start to slide across the spectrum until you'll have a court that's executing people when the probability, based upon circumstantial evidence, that they're guilty is 10%. The Rambam writes in the last line, Ulizakos elef chotim, to exonerate 1,000 sinners, is yoser tov v'nichsaf, is better and more desired, meharog zakai echad yom echad, to kill one innocent person. That is the bias of the halachic system, and certainly he's talking about dinei nefashos, but it's true about onshin, about punishments in general. If we stopped here, the halacha might be clear, but the results would be terrifying. In the absence of our being certain of abuse and clear witnessing, which again, no abusers wait for two male witnesses above the age of bar mitzvah to be there to commit their abuse, there would be so many abusers who would easily continue to prey on their victims despite reasonable suspicions. The Gemara in Nida, however, complicates the picture. It is source number 6. The Gemara speaks of a passage in Yirmiyahu where it seems that the Navi blames Gedaliah ben Achikam for his own death and for the death of the people around him. And the Gemara explains that Gedaliah is blamed because it was his fault. He was warned by some of his men that Yishmael ben Nesanya wanted to assassinate him. And Gedaliah just dismissed it with a wave of the hand. He wouldn't take precautions. And in fact, the rumors were correct. And therefore, Gedaliah, at least, should have been careful. He should have had extra guards. He should have been very careful when Yishmael came for a meal. And the Gemara says because of that, he is, in a sense, held liable or responsible for the death of all of those people. Based upon this, Rava, in the third line in source number 6, states the following. Amar Rava, Haidi Shana Bisha, this Lashon Hara, Afal Pi de le Kabule Lomi Bai, even though you're not supposed to accept it as true, Mechash Lomi Bai, you still have to be suspicious. In other words, you don't accept it categorically, but you don't ignore it. And the Gemara goes on to tell a story of a few people who came to Rabbi Tarfon, they said, we've been accused of theft, please hide us. And he said, look, I'm not going to believe the accusations, I can't necessarily accept it totally, so I'm not going to turn you over to the government. But on the other hand, there are grounds for suspicion, so I'm not going to hide you either. So go hide yourselves. So the point of the Gemara is that even though we don't absolutely at the outset, without evidence, without greater credence, believe every allegation, we have to at least be suspicious. We have to be cautious. The trickiest part is threading the needle of not being mekabel, but being choshesh and knowing when to do it. And here I would suggest a fundamental distinction between punishing someone in a situation of genuine doubt versus removing them from a situation of future potential danger. And the governing principle in both of these is hamotzi mechaveir olav haraya, that the person who wants to establish something has to prove if they're taking away from somebody else. It is clear that the halachic system, and it seems to me to be true of American jurisprudence as well, leans towards acquitting the guilty over convicting the innocent. If we speak about punishing the accused when Jewish courts had the power to do so, or taking away something from somebody when it is already in their domain, it seems that we err in favor of the accused when we have genuine doubt. That means not only are they not punished, but it also means that if you have a person who's under contract, even if you do not want to allow them to continue to work, you have to pay them for the remainder of their contract. To terminate them without paying them would be hamotzi mechaveira olav haraya, and we don't have that proof. But on the other hand, lemechash mibay, we have to take the allegation seriously, and when we can't resolve it, and we are really genuinely left with doubt, it probably means that we have to remove that situation from the situation of danger. If it's a teacher, it has to be removed from the classroom. And when the person's contract were up, we would, in that situation, not renew them. And I should stress here that we're talking about situations of genuine doubt. If we are speaking of a great likelihood in one direction or another, this could change. There are types of accusations where the likelihood of an allegation being false is extremely low. For example, I'm told it's not my expertise, but a young child claiming that they were sexually abused, the percentage of cases that turn out to be false are very, very low. And there are others where the likelihood of being false is much greater. If a student has been punished by a principal or a teacher, you know, a high school student, and all of a sudden starts making allegations of abuse, it doesn't mean it's not true, but obviously it raises, we have more doubts at least starting it. And obviously we are obligated to make a serious investigation, but it is more likely that it may not be the case. The Gemara has a very interesting category. It's on the second page in the source sheets that very much relates to this. The Gemara in Kiddushin states, source number 7, Amar Rav, Malkin an lo tova hashmua. Rav says that if there are rumors surrounding a person, this is more in the context of sexual misbehavior, not abuse per se, but arayos. So Rav says that a bad rumors running around about a person is enough to actually give them malkos. The Rambam writes, quoting this in Hilchos Sanhedrin, source number 8, The Rambam says that the Beis Din has the power to punish someone where there are rumors about him and everybody's talking about what he's been doing. Ben he says, though, they have to be unceasing rumors. You have to make sure that there aren't any known enemies, you know, who are purposely slandering him. How to map these two categories of when lo tova hashmua is to be taken seriously versus when one enemy is slandering a person is best left to experts in the field. That is to decide whether one is likely guilty, likely innocent, or unclear, what I would term genuine doubt. Every case must be investigated as thoroughly as humanly possible, with judgment suspended until the outcome has been given. But sometimes we are going to be unsure at the end of the day. And it is in these cases where there is genuine doubt where I believe that the principle has to be applied of, on the one hand, likabule lomi boy, you can't accept it outright, but lemechash boy, you have to take precautions. We need to remember very carefully as a community, as individuals, the danger of doubts. Rabbeinu Yonah, in the beginning of Brachos, makes an observation about how dangerous doubtful cases are. The halacha is that if I eat chelev, if I'm a chalal Shabbos, I desecrate the Shabbos by accident, I have to bring a karban chatas, a sin offering. How much does it cost? A ma'a, a danka. It costs almost nothing. If I'm not sure whether I violated the Shabbos or ate the prohibited food, I have to bring an asham toloi, which has a minimum cost of, Rabbeinu Yonah says, 48 times that. The Torah is more machmir, is more stringent with the punishment of a korban by a suffek, by a doubtful case, than by a case of certitude. And the reason is obvious, but because most people of good faith, by cases of certitude, understand what has to be done. But in cases of doubt, it's very easy for us to sign, well, you know, it's not an issue, it's not a problem, how seriously should we take it? We have to be very, very careful about sfeikos. The second issue that I want to explore briefly in these sources is about the rules of evidence. And anybody who thinks about the case about abuse almost immediately realizes that if the Torah requires two witnesses for anything, any type of case, how will you ever have witnesses in most cases, let's say, of sexual abuse? Maybe a lot of cases of physical abuse as well. And the Rambam writes, he writes this in his commentary to the Mishnah in the first parak of Bava Kamma, and in Mishnah Torah at source number 11, that one might have thought that since, for example, when dealing with animals, who is most likely to be found in the stables with the horses and the other animals to know which animal damaged which animal? So the Rambam says probably the slaves who work in the stables. So you would have thought that maybe we should accept the testimony of slaves. So the Rambam says no, that the Torah demands that two witnesses, two kosher witnesses are required. And that could make life, of course, very difficult. But the Rambam himself writes elsewhere in source number 12 something which is astounding. The Rambam writes that a dayon in dine mamonos, in monetary cases, if he understands what the witnesses are saying, he knows the witnesses, he knows things about the case, and he is absolutely convinced that one party is lying, the dayan is actually allowed to judge on that basis. And he claims something astounding. He writes at the end of the halacha, the only time that the Torah requires two kosher witnesses is when a dayan doesn't actually know anything about the story, about the litigants at all, and two kosher witnesses come in, then the Torah says the dayan, the judge, should accept that testimony as fact. But when the dayan has other information, knowing the parties involved, so the Rambam says he can judge on that basis. Now, to be honest, the Rambam in the next halacha says, you know, we don't do this anymore because every judge thinks that he's an expert in judging people and figuring out the circumstances. But nonetheless, at least from a theoretical vantage point, it's an astounding statement which basically undercuts what we normally think of the demands of the standard rules of evidence in halacha. The Rashba in a tshuva, it's source number 13, writes something also astounding. He says, I'm just going to translate, he writes that in situations of communal governance where people have been chosen as the judges of the community, he says they are permitted to impose financial penalties or physical punishments based upon what would appear to them to be correct. That's the only way the world can function and survive. He says if you would demand, this is an incredible statement, if you would demand everything to follow the dinim that are set by the Torah, the laws that are set by the Torah, and not to punish anyone, except for the way the Torah set the punishment, with those standards of testimony, like by cases of physical damages to people and similar, the world would be destroyed. Because we would require witnesses and warning in every single case. So I thought, yeah, that's what the halacha says. The Rashba says if you were to do that, the world would be destroyed. He quotes, or maybe misquotes, a Gemara in Bava Tzia, which says that Lo Charva Yerushalayim Ela Al Shadonu Ba Din Torah. You know why Yerushalayim was destroyed, the Gemara says? Because they judged the laws of Torah at Yerushalayim. The Gemara offers a different interpretation than the Rashba here says, but he says basically, if you follow the strict letter of the law and of evidence and things of that nature, the world would fall apart. Now, the Rashba is a little bit complicated from a broader perspective, because he's actually moved into an area that's known as Beis Din Makin for Onshin Shalom and Adin. Beis Din, the court, actually goes beyond the letter of the law, but it's also very, and the broader implications for this are actually astounding, but I don't want to talk about them now. The notion that the court system can't function by actually following the laws, and it has to step beyond that. But it's quite clear from the Rashba that the expectation is that we need to rely upon non-standard evidence if we are going to function, not just in our case, but in every case. And it is in this spirit that the Ramah, in Simon Lamed Hay in Shulchan Aruch, its source number 16, quotes something really interesting. First, he quotes the Rambam that I referred to before, that the Rambam says, you can't, just because it's hard to find witnesses in certain kinds of cases, doesn't mean that you can rely upon non-kosher witnesses. But then the Ramah writes, if you look at the third line in source 16, he says, V'chol ze midina. That's only true by the letter of the law. Avo yesh omrim takanos kadmonim hu, that there is a enactment of the earlier generations, de b'makom she'ein anoshim regilim lios, in places where men are not typically found, kigon bebeis ha'kneshes shel noshim, the women's section, not like in shuls today, but when women's sections were actually in separate rooms, the men couldn't even see in there. O bishar davar akroy, she'isha regila v'lo anoshim, any other case that comes up where typically women are there and not men, kigon lomar, he gives examples, if ein regilim anashim ladaktek bazeh, nashim are nemanos, which we rely upon women to testify. V'lochein, the Rama says, therefore, yesh misha kasav dafilu isha yechida, even a single woman. Normally we require two male witnesses. Here, even a single woman, okarov, a relative, okatan, a minor, nemanim, they are believed in all sorts of cases. That's the takana, because otherwise we couldn't function. And I believe that this is, in fact, the accepted practice. Right? In most cases of abuse, by definition, you're not going to have kosher witnesses. You're probably not even going to have witnesses. But if you have a witness, it's going to be a katan. It's going to be someone who is what we would say no gebedavar, and someone who has a vested interest. They may be the victim, him or herself. That's the only way that the world can function. And that is actually recognized by the halacha. Very briefly, I want to just talk about a little bit the issue of mesira. Some of you are familiar with the topic. Some of you are not familiar with it. Some people have an opinion about it. The issue of Mesira was a very, very serious issue in Jewish communities over the ages. The word Mesira means to hand over, in this case it means to hand over a Jew to the non-Jewish authorities. The term itself comes from a world in which there was autonomy for the Jewish community, where most matters were handled by the Jewish community internally, except for maybe taxes. And other than that, the outside community, other than persecuting us on occasion, they left us alone. Right? We were in charge of dealing with our own internal stuff. The Shulchan Aruch writes, with regards to Mesira, source number 17, that Osir Limsor the Yisrael B'yad Akum Anosim Bein Begufo Bein B'mamono. Vafilu Haya Rasha U'Bal Averos Vafilu Haya Meitzer Lo Mitzaro. So the Shulchan Aruch says, even if someone is bothering you, you're not allowed to be moser them. You're not allowed to hand them over. The Rambam writes, and this is actually important, and some of the posts can quote in our context, for some of them, for those who think Mesira might be an issue, in source number 18, that in medieval communities, they used to kill Mosrim. Mosrim were considered rodef. That was probably the only place they engaged in capital punishment. A Moser who threatened to go to the authorities, which might endanger the Jewish community, the Rambam says, if Osa HaMoser Shazama Mumasar, if someone committed an act of Mesira, Yero Elisha Osa Lahargo, you're not allowed to kill him. Ela Imkein Huchsak Limsar, if he developed the pattern, HaReze Yehare Shema Yimsar Acherim, he has to be killed lest he do it to other people. In other words, it's not a punishment. It's a preventative action. It's like the law of the pursuer. And he says, Umasim becholzman be'orei hamarav. This was true all the time in the Spanish lands, in the West. Larog hamosrim shehuchsuku limsar mamon Yisrael. It was common practice to kill mosrim even if they were only hand over communal property. If they couldn't kill them themselves, they would hand them over to the Gentile authorities and ask them to execute them. V'chein, the Rambam says, kol hameitzer litzibur mitzar osan. If someone does harm, is causing pain to the community, not an individual, mutar lemosro biyad goyim lahakosro ulosro lekonsa. You can hand them over. Avol mipnei tzar yochid osro limsor. You're not allowed to do it for only one individual being harmed. So this is often something that people raise. Ah, you can't do anything because it's Mesira. The Aruch HaShulchan, in a somewhat famous passage, in Chosh HaMishpat writes something incredible. And I think it's pretty clear he didn't write this for the censors, because while he speaks highly of the Tsar, he also speaks highly of the British authorities. He writes, this is added to, after he discusses the laws of Mesira, it's the last source on the sheet, source number 20. Yadua l'chol korei hadoros. Anybody who's familiar with history knows shebizman kadmon b'medinos harachokos lo haya le'ish bitachon begufo u'mamono m'pnei ha'shodedim v'hanasim. People, there was no security for people. People weren't safe from authorities. Af shenasu aleim shem misra. Even people who claimed to be officially appointed governors and so on, basically there was no law and order. Ki yadua gam hayom, something that the current president might have said, me eze medinos me Africa, hashod v'hachamos shepachos hamemshala osim. Right? Governments where there's no law and order. I don't think he used any nasty terms, but he's describing a reality of the world of where there was chaos, there was hefker. V'altov yizachru malchei Europa. And blessed are the kings, the governments in Europe. Uviyichur Adonenu Hakira, the czar, me Russia, va'avosav ha'kesarim, umalchei Britannia, and the kings of Britain, she porsu kanfei memshaltam b'artzos ha'shachogos. I guess he liked colonialism, but they basically installed law and order in the world. Leman yehi lechol ish v'ish bitachon agufa omamono ba'ofan sho'ashirim lo yitzdarchu lahaster atzman. The wealthy people don't have to be afraid of hiding their money because there's law and order. And he says, in these cases, there's no mesira. So basically, the Aruch HaShulchan says, there's no Mesira by the Tsar, which I frankly find hard to believe, by the kings of Russia. Certainly, if the Aruch HaShulchan had seen the government of Israel, the government of the United States, I suspect he certainly would have included them in that. So that's I know that there's much more to talk about in this issue, but this is why, at least not everybody agrees, do not see Mesira as an issue. But I would like to make a few more comments, go just one step further than the Aruch HaShulchan. In a democracy where Jews are not recognized as a separate entity, I don't think there can be such a thing as Mesira. We are equally a part of the system of justice as are all other citizens. The whole conception of Mesira is an autonomous Jewish community handing over a Jew to be handled or punished by the outside non-Jewish polity. For us, there is no inside and outside. Number two, just as a reality of what happens for what people who work in the field tell me, it is far more likely that authorities will not punish a person who will be guilty than punish an innocent person. That isn't to say that it can't happen, but that is the nature of every justice system, including Chosha Mishpat. No system is perfect in its execution, including the system of Jewish courts, of Batei Din. Finally, with regards to the question of Mesira, some have raised a serious concern about the nature of the penal system, meaning the concept of prison from a halachic perspective, which doesn't actually exist, and more specifically, the system of incarceration as practiced in the United States. To this, I would say three things. Number one, the likelihood of incarceration is very small. Number two, even if one regards prison by definition as shelo kedin, an improper punishment, the Maharik, cited by the Rama in Choshen Mishpat, the fourth siman, assumes that when the only way to enforce that which is necessary is by means of the non-Jews, and there is no way of avoiding unjust collateral damage, then so be it. And we have no means of stopping abusers on our own, since we have no communal autonomy or power. And finally, I think it is hypocritical to ignore the pressing need for criminal justice reform when it affects other communities, and then all of a sudden, when it affects a few people in our community, to start complaining about the injustices of the penal system. I believe that there are very serious issues that exist in the American justice system. It is far from perfect, and maybe a generous assessment, but we are among the people who are the least of its victims. So in summary then, I would say that number one, in situations of genuine doubt, we cannot punish, but we also have to be choshesh, we have to be lemechash, to not allow the doubtful abuser to remain in a position where they have access to the vulnerable. Number two, evidence in cases of abuse that can only be obtained by accepting the Rama's takana, and if we don't do that, we will not be able to function as a safe community. And number three, Mesira should not be a concern in reporting abuse or suspected abuse to the secular authorities. There is one more issue that I referred to earlier, which I want to return now. Until now, we have spoken about two kinds of doubtful situations, but both of them are fundamentally about determining the facts, whether something that is unquestionably abuse has actually happened. And my impression is that our communal institutions have greatly improved in the handling of these cases. That is, that there is far greater awareness and sensitivity. I would imagine that for some institutions, significant improvement is needed, and for all institutions, continued vigilance should be a priority. But there is another kind of doubt that I described earlier, which concerns me deeply, particularly as an educator. When there is a behavior where everybody sees what is going on, but many are not sure how to interpret it. And here I speak to the concern or the phenomenon of charismatic leadership. When I was a student, teachers were there to teach, not to be our friends. I don't mean that as a statement of nostalgia. There were plenty of problems with many teachers then, and I appreciate the importance of students being able to develop serious relationships with teachers who make themselves available. With many of those teachers, in my day, it was the case that not only were they not friends of the students, a good thing to my mind, but they were also unavailable and unrelatable, not such a good thing. Today, most schools want to hire teachers who connect with students. That's a good thing. And the schools make it part of the teacher's mission to do so. In many cases, there are wonderful teachers who are wonderful role models and make themselves available to students and subsequently develop wonderful, appropriate, and beneficial, even sometimes long-term relationships. But there are some teachers who understand their mission not only to be available to students, but to insert themselves into their students' lives and to shape and mold them. They become a bit like gurus to the students. Some of the students think it's great, and manipulation and control can occur. The relationship becomes more about the teacher and less about the student. I find this to be deeply problematic. Why do I describe this as doubtful? Well, first, there is no obvious abuse in the sense of inappropriate sexual contact or physical abuse. The line between being available and involved versus being too involved and controlling can often be unclear to the onlooker, and there's a tendency to dismiss the concern. Second, there are many parents in schools who seem to be perfectly fine with placing their children in these situations. My wife and I often refer to this, some boot camp in Arizona where people send their children to be fixed. Every few years, you hear about a kid who died there. But parents seem to be, some of them seem to be perfectly comfortable in putting their children in these situations to help fix them. And thus, I term it a kind of doubt, because if lots of good people know about something and yet think that it is good for their children to be placed into a situation, such a situation, can it really be abuse? The answer to that question, in the opinion of every mental health professional that I've spoken with, is yes. But it's quite complicated when large numbers of people don't see it that way. As a community, we need to open our eyes to this. I close with an observation that the Prima Gaudem makes in a number of places in his commentary. He notes that mi shelo ta'am hatoras hasfeikos, one who has not tasted the joy of resolving doubts, lo ta'am tam simcha me'olam, he has never tasted a taste of real joy. He notes, unfortunately, we don't experience this kind of satisfaction very often. There will be situations where we deal with genuine doubt, but that's we're left with this nagging question. Our responsibility, both communally and individually, is to treat these issues with kovet rosh, with seriousness and seichel, nuanced and complex judgment, to implement best practices beforehand, to take the allegations of people who claim to have been victimized seriously. And I have to tell you, people who have not been victims do not understand how hard it is for someone who has been victimized to come forward to talk about it. It seems irrational, but anyone who's been in that situation understands how difficult it is. Their allegations have to be taken seriously, even if we don't jump to conclusions. We have to make sure to have thorough investigations done by the appropriate qualified authorities, and at the same time to act as Chazal warned us, hevu misunim bedin. We need to be cautious in judgment, to understand that there will be situations in which we are not sure. And therefore, l'kabule lo ba'i, we can't accept it as fact, but l'mechash ba'i, we do have to act cautiously, and sometimes that means taking precautions that people will be unhappy with. And to understand that there will be times when we act cautiously, because we rarely experience the joy of hataras hasfeikos, of the definitive resolution of doubts. Thank you.